Imagine creating one of the country's biggest and most iconic businesses without a single rupee of VC money. Entirely bootstrapped, that's the Zerodha story. There's a fintech, that's financial technology revolution, that's taking up the country. More and more people all over the country are choosing to invest their own money, take care of their own personal finances through the medium of technology. So this is an extremely detailed, extremely rich conversation with Nitin Kamath. In the first part, he's just going to take us through the story of Zerodha. What happened before Zerodha? How did he educate himself? How did he make himself prepared in order to execute this kind of a business? And part two will be much more about his personal side of things as well as detailed personal finance education. They're both fantastic episodes. In fact, I'm recording this intro right after I've done the episode with Nitin. And trust me, guys, there's so much to learn from each podcast, but this is one of those podcasts I'm extremely proud of, that this kind of information, this kind of education, this kind of knowledge was put through the medium of the Ranveer Show. Once again, huge thank you from my side to you guys for supporting the Ranveer Show with so much ferocity. Means a lot. Thank you. Make sure you subscribe to all three of our YouTube channels. That's Peer Biceps, Ranveer Alavadia, and The Ranveer Show Clips. An added bonus, follow us on Instagram. What are you doing? But for now, enjoy yourself. This is the Zerodha story like never before. Lots to learn, lots of inspiration packed into this one. It's a storytelling, finance, and deep entrepreneurship-based podcast. I've got Nitin Kamath from Zerodha. Welcome to the Ranveer Show, brother.
Thanks, Ranveer, for having me on this.
What is the secret to creating a mammoth but bootstrapped organization? And I just want to give the viewers some context. There's a lot of people who don't understand what the term bootstrap means. So there's two ways to make money for your company once you start. One is that you raise money through investors, and the other is that you create a product, you play a basic profit and loss game, you accumulate profits and then put it back into the business, and that's how you grow it out. Coming back to the question, so that's your identity. What is the biggest secret to playing this bootstrap game? Because it's not easy.
See, the thing is, you remember back in college, there used to be this girl who used to date no one, and everyone wants to date that girl, not raising VC money has made us into one of those kind of girls, so like everyone in town is interested to figure what is that you do, and everyone wants to date you, so it's, this whole country is kind of gotten stuck into this success equal to raising VC money, which isn't really true, right? Success for a business is, if the business can make money or not, and the thing is, because we didn't raise money when we started the business, we were forced to go and find ways to be profitable, right? And and once we started making some money, we thought, what's the point of raising VC money, right? As in, there is a lot of independence that comes along by just remaining, bootstrapped and not having VCs. And today as a business, even though we are this mammoth, I keep telling this to some of my, guys in the office, that we are like an elephant that runs like a cheetah, right? And the reason for the nimbleness is not having all these professional investors whom you have to go and ask questions before your decisions are taken, right? So like, I could be having this conversation with you, take an idea from you and, Monday morning go and execute it. And that nimbleness has been the success for the business. Why bootstrapped? When we started off, no one was really interested in giving money. And then when we started making money, then we saw no point in doing it, right? And the other angle that I don't know most people, even the young folks don't understand, is in India, making profits and taking money from a company is a lot more expensive than getting a VC to invest and take money. I'll explain you why, right? So if you make a profit as a company, you have to pay your 25% taxes, then you have to pay dividend distribution tax of 20%, right? And now from last year onwards, in the hands of the promoter, you still have to pay the tax on the dividends again, right? So you're essentially paying 55% taxes before you take profit out of the company. right? Now compare this to, say I'm the VC, right? And say, say a VC invests into Zerodha and I sell some of my stake to the VC and I take money. You pay long-term or short-term capital gains, which is between 15 to 20%. So the tax incentive in India is structured for promoters to sell stake and make money than to make profits and make money, right? And that's one of the reasons I think a lot of these companies, promoters look at even, making money by selling their stake versus trying to make profitable companies and, earn out of it as dividends, So it's, I keep bringing this up, saying that, we should maybe incentivize this, right? Otherwise, this will keep happening, right? As in, people will always look at the easier way to make money, which is selling stakes. And selling stakes means you have to raise money, grow company, then try to make it bigger, get more investors in. So we are for sure in one of those bubble times where, it's easy to, somehow create a company which seems to have a lot of valuation and in very, very quick time. So let's see how all of this plays out.
What's the story? What's the actual story? What were you doing when you were 17? What were you doing when you were 22? What were you thinking 11 or 12 years ago when you were just figuring that this is what you wanted to do? What is going on in your head at those stages of life?
So the thing is, at 16, 17, I started trading the markets. I used to live in this area dominated by Marwadis. So I'm a Brahmin boy. So I'm I'm probably the only businessman in our extended family, So I was in this place where there were a lot of these Marwadis around and they got introduced to stock markets. So I started buying and selling shares back in 97, 98. So it's almost like 22, 23 years now. And then by 2001, I had saved some money up. But in India, there was this new thing that was introduced in 2001 called futures and options. Today, futures and options contribute to almost 90% of the exchange turnover. But it's a product where traders,
Could you explain that? Could you explain futures and options in a simple way?
So the thing is, a lot of people, right, when you talk stock markets, what they think is you buy a stock, wait for the stock price to appreciate, and then sell it after a while, right? Which is, wait for 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. Now, what people don't understand is that turnover is just 1% of the exchange turnover, right? Where people buy stock, wait for the stock price to appreciate and sell, right? The rest of the turnover is actually, in the market is very speculative. Right. So there is a lot of this intraday trading that happens, which is, you buy and sell shares within a day. You buy in the morning and then you sell in some time. Right. So that is 10% of the turnover. The remaining 90% comes from this product called as futures and options. Right. What futures and options is, I think the simplest form of futures is, a sale agreement. Right. If you have a land and I am a real estate, say, agent, right, I come to you and I ask you, you have this property for 50 lakh rupees. I will pay you 1 lakh rupee premium. Keep this, sign a sale agreement with me. And my job is to go sell at whatever price, right? But the agreement between you and me is 50 lakh rupees. And that 1 lakh, which I give you as a premium for signing that agreement. Now, say in 2 months, if I don't find a buyer for it, you get to keep the 1 lakh rupees, right? That's how typical real estate sale agreements work, right? Now, that is called as a call option, okay? So you can do exactly the same thing in a stock market with stocks, right? And the good thing about futures and options is that you can make money both on the way up and on the way down, right? I mean, if you've seen The Big Short, the movie, right? So this guy makes a lot of money in 2008 when the market crashes, right? Now, how do you make money if the only thing you can do in the market is buy stock, wait for it to go up, right? As in, you can't. The way to make money when markets go down is using futures and options. Right. It's quite complex to kind of explain it in like 1 or 2 minutes, but it is 90% of the exchange turnover, So people who speculate, who trade, find futures and options very exciting. And the problem with leverage in life is that leverage is like weapons of mass destruction. You make money, you make money fast. You lose money, you lose it faster. Right. So. What leverage means is that with your 1 lakh rupees, you're not buying 1 lakh rupees of stocks. You're actually buying 5 lakh rupees of stocks, right? Which means if a stock goes up 10%, you're not making 10%, but you're actually making 50% of your capital. But the other problem is, you know, if it goes down 10%, you are losing 50% of your cap, right? So it's you know, it's everything multiplied, right? As in, so futures and options comes with leverage, and that's what is exciting for people, which is, you know, you can make money fast. So 2001, I started trading the markets in futures and options, and that whole leverage was very inducing, tempting, whatever you can call. And I blew up my account, and I had borrowed money and tried to make up. And so I was in, I was in one of those points in life where I was in minus, where I was owing a lot of people money. So I went, found myself a job in a call center, in 2001 and 2, and call center because, you know, I could trade during days and, I could work in the nighttime. Right? And then back in 2001 and 2, call center was the coolest place in town, by the way, you know, so it is. And all the good looking girls used to work there. And then, you know, and it was all this, you know, it was almost like airline industries, right? As in everyone wanted to work in airlines at one point, right? So call center had that thing going for it in the first 2-3 years between 2001 to 2005, you know, and then kind of.
Did you meet your wife there?
Yes, I did actually, you know. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Go on.
Yeah. So I worked in a call center for 3-4 years. And in 2005, I met this gentleman at the gym, and he was, he asked me, dude, what do you do? And I showed him my account performance. And I used to trade with a brokerage called ICSA Direct. And he saw my performance for those 3-4 years. And he said, dude, can you do this for me? And I said, okay, why not? So he cut me a check. So I was essentially managing his portfolio. I quit my job and I started this portfolio advisory company in 2005. And
nice.
A lot of random things in life, every story, you know, probably has these tipping points, right? Where I could have easily continued to work in a call center. You know, I've been a telecommunication engineering college. Degree,
up top. Know. If I could fist bump you through the screen, I would. I know your pain, my brother.
Yeah. So, I could have been an engineer if I studied well and all of that. I mean, if this whole trading bug, you know, if say my dad was transferred to another city, he was working in a bank. You know, he was transferred to another city, I would probably have been never introduced to stock markets in my life. And so like that, you know, a lot of happenstances, and this person I met in 2005, he gave me a check. I quit my job. He introduced his friends, started making some money for these folks. So then slowly that business started going up. Then I became a franchisee for a bigger brokerage firm. You know, it's Reliance had a, you know, broking firm as well called Reliance Money. I became a franchisee for it in 2006. By then my younger brother had joined me, and he you can call it evolution or whatever. He's 7 years younger to me, and he's a much sharper trader than I am, you know, I ever was. So in 2008, you know, we guys made some money when the markets fell. And then that was a realization that, dude, you know, if he's a better trader, why should I trade? You know, I mean, in the sense, it didn't really make sense, because, you know, in trading, it's not like, you know, it's not like manual work, right? As in, it's not like, you know, two people can... Yeah.
Also, I'm sorry I'm interrupting you in the middle, but I have an honest, curious question. And before we get to the actual Zerodha story,
right,
you know, I always have this theorem that if you want to build a startup that deals with sweepers, if you're providing sweepers for the road, you need to be a sweeper yourself.
Absolutely.
First, and then therefore you'll make the better startup. So speaking specifically about trading, when you said that your brother was a better trader than you, how do you actually become a better trader? Is it instinct based? Is it like studying based? Is it numbers based? Like, how do you become a Wolf of Wall Street kind of?
Yeah, no, I mean, see, thing is, trading is like an art, you know, I mean, at the extreme levels, right? As in, you can be an average trader, you know, you can learn, study and be an average trader, you know, put some money on the table. You know, if you're trading for a living, you can put food on the table, right? But you want to really hit home, you have to have that little extra, and that is genetics. You know, I don't think you can really learn that stuff. You know, it's like, can I learn football and become Messi, right? I mean, it's not gonna happen, right? As in, you need to have the genes in you in some form. So I think, you know, you can only push yourself to a certain extent, and over and above that, you know, the genetics kind of lottery takes over, right? And I mean, it's the same thing like you, right? As in, not everyone can do a podcast like you. I mean, of course, you know, you can teach someone whatever you know, but you might end up doing a decent job, but you may not be able to actually match your standard ever, right? So it's, That's because you probably have, you know, some kind of a genetic lottery as well. So, and in trading, the thing about trading, right, is that there's no gray areas. There is just black and white, right? Either you make money or you're not making money, right? Now, like, you know, for you as success, you know, probably it could be how many people view your podcast, et cetera, right? And how people view your podcast could be because of your persona and so many factors, right? As in, but in trading, it's not that, you know, I mean, everything boils down to, did you make money today or you didn't make money? As in, you know, because there could be a podcaster who's got a lot of views, but doesn't make any money, right? But so it's very tough to define success and failure. But in stock markets, the thing is that it's, you know, you see what's your P&L is your, you know, it's very black and white, you know, so you either make money or you don't make money.
But the way Messi would, you know, cut people or has God-given agility or whatever you want to call it, specifically in a trader's mind, what are genetic gifts that will make you a better trader? Is it just instinct? Is it like, okay, this stock, I believe in it. And just having that sixth sense about certain stocks, is it that?
No, it's not that actually. You know, that's what a lot of people make it out in a lot of stock market movies, that somehow, you know, the guy who, you know, who takes the most risk is the one who makes money. But it's actually the opposite. The people who make money trading the markets are people who are most conservative about risks, you know, because it's, this is not, you know, there's not something that you're not trading for one day, right? It's not the one lottery you're going to hit and, you know, you're going to make a lot of money and take home, right? You have to trade daily. You have to trade continuously over a long period of time. And being conservative is actually the most important thing when trading. And I think instinctively, a lot of people like to be heroes. Right? So they want to, you know, hit that sixer, right? They don't want to take six one runs, right? As in, and that's the problem, you know, with most people. You know, everyone's trying to be hero and they're trying to, you know, trade more than what they're supposed to trade. And a lot of times, you know, you end up becoming a compulsive trader. You know, the best trades in the markets is when you don't trade, right? Because if you're not in a trade, you know, you're rational enough to see an opportunity as an opportunity, right? If you're stuck in something, right, you can't even see it as an opportunity, right? You kind of let go of a lot of opportunities. So, you know, just to be wired like that is very tough. You know, it's, you can't just read and wire yourself like that. And that, you know, that whole saying, there's not a one day thing. This is a lifelong thing. You know, this is a lot of grinding. You know, it's a, you know, if people play poker, you know, they would know, right? You know, what's a grinder? It's just, you know, you wait for your good hands and then you bet, right? You don't just, you know, try to keep betting every hand. Right. So stuff like that. You know, and a lot of that, you know, is people don't get it, you know, and I think one of the challenges in India also is that the financial knowledge, you know, we are never taught finance in school and college, right? As in, like, you know, you come out of college, you end up either doing what your parents did or you end up picking it up from your friends. And most likely what your friends are doing are wrong. So, you know, what we have today is a country full of financial illiterates. You know, I mean, even though they understand 100%. Finance, but they don't really understand how to really go about it. And that's one of the things, you know, we've been, you know, like, it keeps bugging me. Like, how do you fix this problem in this country?
Honestly, I don't think it's limited to just finance. I think it's limited to a host of other soft skills, including things like communication, including things like business, which is not taught that in school, which is why the whole new education policy is fantastic for the country. But the other thing I really want to highlight, and this is what I get from you, and I'm not talking about Nitin the entrepreneur, I'm talking about Nitin the guy. You're a lot like Rahul Dravid. Like, your energy is a lot like Rahul Dravid. And even the kind of trading energy you described in terms of, okay, you know, that's what you need, that you need to be able to be consistent. It's a very Rahul Dravid-esque
it's a very stoic. It's a stoic approach to life. You know, you can't let...
100%.
You can't, you know, in the sense, stock markets is like a roller coaster, okay? And if you keep getting excited every time it's up and down, you know, you can enjoy the roller coaster for 5 minutes and then, you know, you're going to get frustrated after that, right? As in... So if you want to kind of survive, you need to just be stoic about the whole thing.
I also feel that when you're running a bootstrap business and you're growing it gradually, the same kind of mentality of consistency, test match cricket, that applies. Hit your ones and twos. And you know, dude, this is something I see with a lot of people from Bangalore in general, which is a whole section of the podcast I want to break down later, that why does Bangalore breed people like you, people like Rahul Dravid, with this calm, you know, ones and twos mentality, you know, the slow build-up mentality, you, your brother, and why is it also the startup hub? But through your story, I want to know, like, the whole Zerodha story, how did you transition into saying, okay, you know what, let's build a massive company now?
No. The thing is, I don't think you can really start. You can really have that, you know, I will build a big company or I'll make this much money. You know, I don't know if that stuff really works in life, right? As in, you know, there's this very interesting thing. This friend who gave me the first check, you know, said about, you know, why this, you know, goddess Lakshmi sits on a lotus, you know, and he was, and you know, Saraswati sits on a rock, right? I mean, there is a significance to this. I mean, you could call it some kind of bias that you're finding these significances, but his story was, you know, lotus, you know, money is like, is floating, you know, it's never with you, right? You know, if you want to get to money, you can't swim to a lotus, you know, you have to kind of do the right things and hope she comes to you, right? And Saraswati is like education, right? What you learn, etc. It's rock, you know, it doesn't move anywhere, right? And I think one of the learnings, you know, through my life being a trader was that you can't focus on money, right? Because if you make money as an objective or you make success as an objective in terms of how big you will get, or how big a company you want to make, you get distracted, right? I think the focus has to be in just, you know, following, doing the right thing, you know, what, do the right thing for your business, do the right thing for the people who work with you. And, you know, and in this business and in generally in life, you know, being right place, right time is extremely important. You know, you can make the greatest curry of your life and there's no salt. I mean, no one's going to eat that, right? So, and, you know, that whole right place, right time, you know, is also extremely important. And what I've realized, I mean, I don't know if I end up sounding like a guruji, but what I've realized is that, you know, if the more good you do, the higher the odds of right place, right time happens. In the sense, you know, the more good you are to others, you know, if you take care of your customers really well, you know, they will remember you and they will help you grow the world, right? I mean, until now, for Zerodha, we haven't spent a single rupee on advertisement. You know, not a single AdWord campaign, not a single Google ad, whatever, right? So it's, so we have 3 million customers and we have done it without a single rupee. And that's happening because of the same approach that, you know, we are always constantly trying to help a customer, right? Same way, you know, the top 100 people who join Zerodha, the first 100, they haven't quit till date. You know, maybe 2 or 3, we've asked them to leave, 1 or 2, but, you know, so we probably have the highest retention of employees. Our tech team is a 30-member team, you know, really tiny team. You know, it's like one of those X-Men kind of a team. And not a single person from our tech team has quit till date, right? I mean, so you know, when you ask for success, right, as in, these are essential ingredients, right? As in, it is, you know, because you need your people, you need your customer, and you need your product, right? And if people are happy, they'll build a good product. And, you know, if customers are happy, they'll go and talk about you and help you grow the business. So, I think that lesson was, you know, I think learning was from trading, actually. You know, I think my journey as a trader, I became a better trader when I stopped focusing on money. Because, you know, when I was younger, you know, every day I was like, well, I need to make 1,000 rupees today, or I need to make 5,000 rupees this week, you know, stuff like that, right? And then you know, to get there, you become very aggressive. And then you forget what are the rules to follow to get there, right? I mean, you can't be messy, get in, say, I want to score a goal today, right? I mean, in this match. Because then, you know, you're probably not going to pass it to your, you know, your other players, and you'll probably screw up the game, right? So it's, that way, you know, that whole learning of trading, etc., helped me significantly. And also, I believe, like, this is something I keep telling people who ask me, what should you do before you start up? Like, I think one of the things you need to do is build a core competency. You know, you can't just wake up one day and say, I want to build this freaking great new business. And, you know, with having no idea of how it works, or, you know, not having any exposure to the industry. And, you know, you can't just wake up one day and be that, you know, and maybe, you know, 1 or 2 will get lucky, you know, I mean, but the odds of you becoming lucky reduces significantly if you don't have any core competence, you know, I mean, like, right. So, I think, you know, before Zerodha, so Zerodha, we started in 2010, right? So I started trading the markets in 97, 98. So there was 13 years of you know, experience before actually Zerodha started, right? And this was not like an overnight thing. You know, a lot of people ask, you know, when they say Zerodha is a 10-year-old business today, I say we're actually a 23-year-old business, because it started the day I started trading the markets. And one of the things that I've enjoyed doing in my life is I'm not really comfortable in front of a camera, but during my call center life, I used to sell on the phone. For 3.5-4 years, I sold almost everything possible to these people in the US, right? With my pseudonym was Nathan Hawk. So I'll enjoy selling on the phone. I used to run some of the largest communities for stock markets in India, you know, throughout the last for 10, 15 years. You know, in my pseudonym, you know, not really as me, as in, so there were all these, you know, I had the largest Yahoo Messenger group of traders. I had the biggest Orkut community and stuff like that. So all of that, you know, was very critical in Zerodha being where it is today. So I don't think there is anything called, you know, easy money as such, right? Or easy success or something, you know, I mean, there is a lot of that goes into it. So 2010.
Like, how old were you when you thought of Zerodha as a startup? Like, as in, like, you know, when you were like, okay, I'm done with just trading and playing this game. Now let's play this game.
Yeah. So 2008. So I was 2008, I was 29. Yeah. So I was 28, 29 years old in 2008, 2009. So that's when this whole idea of Zerodha came by. And also the whole Zerodha idea came by was because there was another enabler. The stock exchange in India, the largest stock exchange in India is called NSE, the National Stock Exchange. And they started giving a free software for people who became members of the stock exchange, you know, free trading software. And so we didn't really have any technology background when we started a business. And so this technology came for free. And we saw an opportunity to kind of offer technology for free, you know, which was coming for free, and see if we can disrupt on the pricing, if we can reduce the cost of per trade and brokerage, etc. And that was essentially how the idea of Zerodha came by, you know, back in 2008, 9.
So at that phase where you were just starting something new, was there nervousness within your mind? Was there hope? Like, what were you thinking on a very human level? Because I'm sure you had your games planned out from a product perspective, from a finance perspective. But what were you thinking about the human aspect of things? That, okay, shit, I'll have to lead a team. I know I've got my brother. You know, I'm sure you had your core kind of figured out. What was going on in the inner world?
Right. No, see, the thing is, when we started the business, it was never really meant to be what it is today. So this was all, you know, just taken different directions as we grew. So when we started the business back in 2010, we were trying to build a brokerage firm for very active day traders like us. Right? It was almost like, you see these people who like rock music, they'll go set up a pub with rock music, you know, stuff like that, right? You know, just for your, you know, really tight-knit, you know, these kind of buddies and stuff like that. And like I said, right, when we started the business, the what we were trying to get after was the cost of trading. Right, you know, when you buy and sell stocks in India, you pay a brokerage fees, and the brokerage fees in India historically has been a percentage fees. That means, you know, you buy for 1 lakh rupees, you'll pay say 500 rupees as commissions. You buy for 10 lakhs, you'll pay 5,000 rupees, right? But in an online world, the cost of executing a trade doesn't go up, right? I mean, it remains same. Right? So if it remains same, the question was that why should the commissions go up? And that was the question that we were trying to ask, you know, when we started the business. And so what we did was we came and said we'll charge a flat fee per trade, irrespective of the size of the trade, right? So when we started, it was, you know, we are trying to reduce the cost for very active traders. And that's how this whole, you know, journey started. And and then we were four people, you know, who were working from before. So it was me, my brother, and two others, you know, and it never, you know, I mean, I never really thought through so far ahead, you know, in the sense I didn't really think that I'll have to lead teams, etc. I had a plan, you know, I had a plan for the first 1 year, which is you build this brokerage firm for active traders like us. And if it doesn't work, I'll get back to trading. So that was the plan B, you know. So, you know, in the first 1 year, we kind of realized that the opportunity is kind of much bigger than, you know, than just trying to cater to the small bunch of customers. You know, the opportunity is probably, because one of the things, you know, one of the things I was scared of before starting the business was, see, in the business of money, right, people don't trust you very easily, right? What it means is, you know, if you want to buy, say, 500 rupees of candies, you'll go to candies.com and you'll buy it. You'll not care who is running the site, who is the promoter, or is, you know, all of that, right? You like the candy, you buy it. But if, say, you want to save 500 rupees, right, you would not do it on a random website. Because, you know, as soon as the word goes from spend to save, now you start questioning if this person is going to be around for 20 years, because my saving is supposed to be long-term. He's going to be the custodian of my asset, right? He, you know, if you save something, the money is somehow in some form lying with that business, right? So is he is a safe guy to be keep the money with? So, you know, all those questions, you know, I never, when I started the business, I didn't really think people will so easily trust you with the money, you know. I mean, it took us a long time, you know. I think, you know, I've seen the, like, you know, if I look at our customer journey, you know, the journey of our customers, you know, most of our customers in the first 1-2 years would never keep more than 25,000-50,000 rupees with us, you know, because I think they were bothered about the credibility of the brand itself, right? And, but, you know, now we have customers who have 50-100 crores, you know, of securities or cash lying with us, you know. So, like I said, I would be lying if I said I'd actually thought so far ahead to think I'll have to build a big team or big business. You know, I think it just, it started off as something else. It was meant to be very small. And then just, it just took this direction where it, you know, it ended up becoming like this.
I read the story of Zerodha in detail. And while you all started with this very traditional business model, and I think there was this moment in your journey where you discovered opportunity. So specifically, did you figure that, oh, by 2020, this younger generation that's kind of sprouting up in India, they will perceive money in a different way? Was that like a part of your realizations? Like, what was the thought process behind? You all went and actually got a CTO, a technical person, a tech person. You're an engineer yourself, but you're my kind of engineer. So we're not really on the tech side. So you figure that, okay, we need an all-out engineer, tech guy to go and now build something new. So what was the opportunity and what was your thought process behind building out tech?
Right. No, I mean, the thing is, so Kailash, who heads our tech, he joined us in 2013. And what happened in around 2012 is, there were a couple of new brokers who copy-pasted our, whatever we were trying to say, right? In the same platform, same kind of branding, which is, I care for the customer, I'm young, I write blog posts and blah, 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 right? So, but then, you know, the realization was, you know, there was no moat for the business, right? As in, for, I think anyone starting up, I think the most important thing to, or any business, right, is to have a moat, right? Which is, what is that advantage you have over your competition, right? If a competition can catch up on you very easily, then, you know, you can't really build a long-term sustainable business, right? And so the, you know, the question we had at that time was, what is a moat, right? And the only moat for a business like us was the product, as in you had to evolve the product into something which is not available with anyone else. And so one of the other things that I have done through my life, I think, which has helped me significantly, is that knowing that I think people who can build products today, you know, technologists are like X-Men of today's world. I seriously think they are, right? Because they're...
And by that, you don't mean just tech. You mean even product designers or people who conceptualize, or you're just talking about tech?
No, I mean, even the guys who... anyone who can take an idea from an idea to a product, right? Like, you know, is like an X-Men, right? And... like, you know, if you've seen the X-Men movie, you know, if you're not the X-Men, the only ones who do well are people or friends of X-Men. You know, I mean, in a sense, like, you make sure you're around some X-Men. So, right. So, I realized that quite early in my life. So what I started doing was, I knew that I can't learn coding for nuts. You know, I mean, I tried it. It's just, you know, it's just going all over the place, right? And so I said, you know, how do I get close to people who are good coders and programmers? So one of the things I started doing was investing, you know, small amounts of check. Now, so anytime I found someone who's seemed like a good product guy, you know, who can actually build products, I started seeing if I can somehow invest a small little check and be around that guy. You know, no intention of making money on the check. And I say check, you know, invest in some form, right? Just to and Kailash was actually, you know, a co-founder of a company called Sensible. Now Sensible has it's relaunched in a different avatar, but in the original avatar, he used to be a co-founder. And I was trying to bankroll that company at that time. And the product didn't fly because you didn't get regulatory approvals. But somehow, you know, we both hit off, you know. And I think one of the secrets for where we are as a business today is actually him and the tech team. Right? Because you can do whatever you want as a business, but if you don't have a great product, you know, it's not going to take you too far ahead. Right. And
when you say you hit it off with your, he's your CTO now.
Right. I mean, he's as good as a co-founder. And I mean, he doesn't like to be called a co-founder, but in all sense, he's a co-founder. You know, so,
right. With, you know, this situation where as an entrepreneur, you figured, okay, my business needs a tech element and you're trying to go out and find a tech person. Other than the actual craft, like how you're good with your numbers and your money and he's good with coding and building a product, do you also have to vibe on like internal human level?
Absolutely.
Like that's what you look for.
Yeah,
because there's a lot of people who can work on their craft, become good coders, but there's few people who you'll be able to connect with as a human.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, and that's where it's important to keep interacting with as many people as possible, you know, especially, you know, in this, you know, you can't just go to a coffee shop and find a co-founder or find someone whom you can trust to build a product, right? And then, and the thing is, I think, like one of the things I've seen in my life, you know, I've invested in a lot of startups is, you know, a lot of startups don't really work because the team doesn't gel well together, you know, forget about the product and, you know, et cetera. But just the fact that the teams can't really bond and be together, and different kind of personalities trying to, you know, come together. You know, and about this, you know, how do you get the right person? Dude, it's goddamn luck. You know, I don't think there is, you know, it's like asking someone, how do you find the right person to get married to, right? As in, you just have to wish that you're lucky, you know? So,
Dude, but what about Kailash made you think that, okay, here's me, here's my brother, we're good with our shit. How do we get a guy who matches our values? So what were those values in him where you were like, okay, this is working?
No, I mean, see, firstly, he's one of the most skilled programmers that I know, you know, developers that I know, you know, personally. So he had that skill going. Right. Second thing was, he's almost like an idealist in the sense, money doesn't drive him. Right. You know, so, you know, there were those kind of similar kind of personalities, you know, where when we spoke, you know, I don't think till date we were ever, you know, as a business, not just him, you know, anyone in the core team, we were ever actually spoken about our revenue targets and stuff like that. Not a, you know, that money has never been a focus at all. Right. Now, in this kind of a mix, if you suddenly bring one guy who wants, you know, who just talks about money all the time, you know, he's going to stand out, right? As in, it has to, I think, you know, I think the important thing here is, assuming, you know, we were one of those kind of companies which was focused on generating revenue, you wanted a CTO who was similar like that, right? You don't want someone who's saying, dude, screw money, you know, let's just build a product. And so, so the team has to kind of bond well, and especially with your product, right? Because, you know, you can't, you know, like a lot of time I keep telling him I am replaceable in the business, but maybe he is not, you know, so, right? Because it's very tough to replace the person who's built a product, you know. And so I think, you know, this goes back to the, you know, original point I was trying to make, which is, you know, you try to be good, you know, it's like karma, right? As in, you know, so you're good to people, you end up meeting people who might think that, oh, this guy is good, he's passionate, you know, I should be around him. Because, you know, you kind of let that kind of aura around you, right? When you're passionate, I'm extremely passionate about stock markets. I mean, I don't know anything other than stock markets in my life, right? And so, you know, so when someone's very passionate and is generally trying to help as many people, so, you know, it's easier to attract good talent to come to you. Now, if I was one of those douche, you know, who's going to be arrogant and etc., you know, I don't think Kailash should have ever happened, you know, so it's a, but the thing again, right, this, I don't think there's a cut, copy, paste that'll work, right? I mean, I don't think someone listening can say, oh, Nitin is like this, so I'll be like this, right? I don't, you know, you have to be true to yourself, right? As in, and that's, you know, you just have to be the best form of you. I don't think you can just copy someone else, you know, so.
100%. You know, I just want to add this one quick nugget here, which is that a lot of successful people will definitely say that luck has been a part of my journey and right place, right time has been a part of my journey. And the obvious response to that is people say, hey, no, but it's all your hard work also. But then the successful person will say, no, but you don't understand how much luck is involved here. And I feel that luck is definitely a huge part of everyone's journeys. Like, what are the chances that you met the exact correct product designer, the exact correct CTO who built this out with you? And honestly, your luck is totally decided by what you said, your karma, how you treat people, how attractive you are as someone to work with, you know, dude. So would you like agree to that, that like luck is a big part of it?
No, I mean, see, the thing is, it's about putting yourself in places where the odds of hitting are higher, right? And the way to put yourself in situation where the odds of hitting higher is doing stuff like what you said, you know, do good karma, right? As in, so you do that, you know, you automatically put in yourself in situations where, you know, everyone's thinking about you, you know, and to say, oh, he did something good to me, I need to reciprocate, right? So if you have 100 people think like that about you, you know, your chances of getting lucky increases. Does it guarantee luck? It doesn't. Right. But there is a way, I think, you know, to, just be in that best situation for the highest chances of luck hitting you, you know. So, yeah. So, no, I completely agree on that. You know, so.
Naval Ravikant actually said something like, just having strong ethics in life is very likely to actually create generational wealth. You will create that generational wealth slower. As in, compared to someone who actually breaks ethics and gets fast money, but it'll be larger in the long term. Again, that's why test match cricket kind of thing. Like, you'll be able to score 300 runs, but do it slowly, do it nicely.
I think the core of all of this is that don't make money as the objective, you know, because you keep money as an objective, 100%. you just end up derailing, you know. So, you know, your objective has to be what potentially can generate money, which is take care of the people around you. You know, take care of your customers and just be focused on improving on a daily basis, you know. So it's...
The reason I highlight money in this conversation is that my observation is, okay, now as someone who's running Zerodha, you have a bird's eye view of your customers and generally the stock market because you're passionate about it. When you're a YouTuber, you get a bird's eye view of the youth in general, your audience, as well as what is the youth of the country thinking. While they're excited by the concept of entrepreneurship, money is a very big personal driving factor for a lot of them because they want to provide a better life for their own families. And I feel the nature of Indians is such that when they actually go down journeys, there are character changes that happen. But early on, when they're like 17, 18, money, wealth, you know, the glam is a driving factor which eventually changes into, oh, okay, product design is a beautiful concept. Impact creation is a beautiful concept. But right now, I think a lot of young kids need to be seduced into this world and then kind of develop into something else. But anyway, that's just what I think, man. You go on with your story.
Yeah. So 2010 is when we started. 2013 when we started our product journey. Then in 2015, we did a very interesting thing. You know, me and Kailash and, you know, our PR guy, we were going to Cochin for a press conference. Our flight got delayed and we were having a drink and I said, dude, you know, we haven't done anything for a while, you know, and I said, you know, why not go zero brokerage for equity investing? Right? It's just out of the blue, you know, and equity invest. Okay. So like I said, right, 90% of the people in the stock markets don't invest. They actively trade. And 99%, actually 1% of the people actually invest, which is buy a stock, wait for it to go up and sell it. So we said, you know, what was happening with Zerodha was we were looked upon as a brand only for active traders and not for investors, right? The problem is with a business like that is that 99% of the people you know around you are investing, right? That means the trading community, even though they contribute a lot of turnover on the stock exchange, they are a very small number of people. Right. So in India, you probably have 5 to 10 lakh day traders or active traders who generate, you know, revenues, you know, for people like us. But there is 70, 80 lakh Indians who invest in the markets. But those 70, 80 lakh Indians who invest contribute only 1% of the exchange turnover. Right. So so we said, you know, if we kind of build a business only for traders, we'll never be able to go after that 70, 80 lakh Indians who invest in the markets. So we said we want to change our kind of branding. So we said, why not? For this crowd, we go zero brokerage. You know, let's take away all the brokerage charges. And that's when, you know, virality hit for the first time for the business. You know, like in 2016, I remember the first, I think, we took the decision on a Saturday and then by Monday, we were zero brokerage. And then Economic Times had this whole thing, watch 10 businessmen to watch for in 2016. And there was Mukesh Ambani, and next to it was, you know, they put my name, right? And then I was like, dude, what the hell just happened? You know, so, you know, Mukesh Ambani for Jio and Nitin Kamath for Zerodha, as I said, you know, and, but what happened was, you know, that the PR that we got at that time, plus the low cost, you know, suddenly just, you know, became almost got as virality as a business, you know, because like I said, right, in this business, credibility is very important and people associate credibility when the paper says it or newspaper says it or TV says it. And so our, you know, real trajectory shift happened in 2016. And in 2015, we had also launched our in-house product, you know, what Kay and, you know, Kailash and his team were building, you know, it's called Kite, which is our web and trading app. You know, we had launched that. So 2016 is when we started, you know, doing well. But the biggest challenge for us as a business was onboarding a customer, right? We had like this 30-page document, which had to be signed. I don't know how many proofs had to be attached. Like, imagine if would a Uber Ola have happened if before sitting in an Uber Ola, you had to sign a 30-page document, right? I mean, demonetization changed that for us, right? Because what demonetization did was people started using Aadhaar. Then people started using Aadhaar for other use cases, which is for KYC, for signature, and all of that. And 2017 is when, you know, it really started taking off because we could now onboard a customer completely online. And during this journey, you know, between 2015, 16, et cetera, we also did a few very interesting things. We launched in 2014 our education initiative called Varsity, which is probably in the top 2-3 in the world now in capital markets. And if you want to learn anything about stock market, it's completely free. There is no Zerodha branding, nothing. No, we just do it out of love. And, you know, it's almost like a way to give back to the society. So we all spend a lot of time, you know, the format is very Wiki plus Quora, you know, in the sense you read an article, there's a lot of Q&A at the end of the article. That did really well. You know, all this investment in startups that I said, you know, I was trying to do, we formalized it and we started an incubator called Rain Matter, right? So, you know, we took like 40, 50 crores of what we had made, put it as a fund. And we said we will now enable new startups to come build niche experiences to grow the capital market ecosystem in the country, right?
So it's all primarily in the world of finance that you're trying to expand for.
Absolutely. Yeah, because see, there are a lot of people today who will write a check, right? I mean, there's no dearth of money, right? As in, I think what we bring on the table is essentially all the knowledge, you know, of the markets, all these compliance issues, you know, we kind of take care of all of that. And most importantly, we give the initial audience to validate your product, right? The biggest challenge in the business of money is just to get your first few customers to trust you with their money, right? And with us, what we have done is all of these startups, we have showcased to our customers saying, you know what, this is almost like us. Why don't you give it a shot and tell us what you think of it, right? And us doing that has helped these startups, you know, they're all, you know, on their own, very successful, you know, and all making money today. So that's one of those, you know, things that I feel very excited about, the fact that we've, you know, been, you know, somehow a part of this, enabling all of these new startups and ideas to become businesses of their own. So that's called Rain Matter. There are around 12 startups there. I mean, we have done, you know, non-fintech as well, but it's more, you know, just out of passion or something like that, you know. But the core, the passionate things that we have funded are all stock market related products and companies. 2020, you know, this whole COVID suddenly changed the world for us completely, you know. So till January, we were 2 million customers. You know, we were still the largest broker in the country, you know, by early Jan. But then from Feb till now, we've added another 1 million customers. So, you know, it took us 9.5 years to add 2 million customers, and it took us like 6 months to add the next 1 million.
Because you have this bird's eye view of your audience, your consumer, what is going on now? Why are people suddenly getting more interested in financial education and fintech? Is it that young people, again, is it that same concept of young people are chasing wealth somewhere, and, you know, that's why people are like latching onto this? What's your opinion on that?
No, I mean, see, the thing is, there are multiple enablers here, right? As in, so I think the first thing what has happened in the country is the interest rates are really low in the bank, right? I mean, your you know, fixed deposit is giving you 5.5% and stuff like that, right? So automatically people are looking for, you know, alternate ways, you know, alternate places to invest into, you know, where it can yield higher than the fixed deposit. You know, the other thing is this whole work from home has enabled people to think about personal finances, right? Because, you know, this whole, otherwise, you know, when people go to work and they're continuously working 8-10 hours a day, by the time they come home, they're already tired. Now, they don't really have too much to think about. Now, I think, you know, people sitting at home, they're like, oh, you know what? You know, there is something called stock market. Maybe it's, you know, we should look at it. The third enabler in this was the markets had fallen. So a lot of stocks were available for cheap, right? You know, if you think of it, right, every time there's a sale, people go queue up, right? You know, if the Big Bazaar had this Big Bazaar day, you know, like there is 1 kilometer of queue outside because people get attracted to discounts. And that happened also in Feb, March, right? Suddenly you had stocks, you know, available at 50, 60% of the cost. And then those stocks bounced back, right? And, you know, April, May, June, stock markets did well. So people who invested then suddenly saw a lot of money, and which meant, you know, they started speaking about it to their friends. So, you know, they're like, oh, you know what? There is a way to make money in the markets. So all of these happened together. And then fourth was, you know, onboarding is today online, right? It's not offline like before. So all of this put together, the fact that you can instantly open an account, I think has just, you know, created this whole rush of people coming to the markets. It's and also, you know, see, in India, there are 400 retail brokerage firms, right? You know, retail broking, stock broking is probably one of the oldest industries in the country because, you know, the Bombay Stock Exchange is the oldest stock exchange in Asia. So India actually has had a past, you know, to the stock markets, you know, relation to the stock markets for a long time. In this whole last 5-6 months, a lot of these brokers who are offline, they have lost out because all their business models were, you know, wired around offline processes, right? I'll send someone to pick up a check after you buy a stock and stuff like that, right? I mean, that has got collapsed. So the top 5-10 online brokers have kind of gained a lot of market share from them. And what you've seen in the last 6 months is that our average age of our customers was 32 before COVID. It's 28 today, you know. So it's just, wow. So it's a lot of, you know, 20 to 30 year olds who are coming in. I think the big challenge of this, like I was just recently tweeting about this, you know, where this crowd doesn't have the money, unfortunately. You know? So, like, you know, the money in India, you know, like there was this thing which, you know, this data that Goldman Sachs put out recently saying 75% of all wealth is with people who are more than 50 years of age. You know, so the problem challenge of building a business for the 20 to 30 year olds in a business of money is that even though you have a lot of customers, you know, these customers together don't really add up to a lot of money, right? You know, which is the one place where we haven't done very well, which is, we haven't done very well in this audience of 50-year-old plus crowd, because this audience needs, you know, relationship managers. They need someone to call up and say, good day, good morning, sir, good afternoon. So, I mean, you know, they're used to a certain way of life and they don't really appreciate, they don't really care for product experience as much as a younger, you know, like a 20 to 30 year old guy, you know, like my dad likes this old Android phone. You know, every time I try to give him a new phone, he's like, no, I like this better. Right? He doesn't want to even shift out of that because he's just used to that product. Right. So that's one place where, you know, we've not been very successful, which is attracting the 45 plus crowd to come open accounts with us. You know?
So the way I look at it, I mean, personally, I feel like you're sitting on this volcano of growth eventually, because I just feel that younger people now, like in their early 20s, there's a lot of entrepreneurial energy. There's a lot of, you know, energy when it comes to, again, personal finances. There's a lot of thoughts behind, okay, how do I grow to that next level? Because honestly, considering the fact that I'm guessing a big chunk of your audience is tier one cities in India, like, and therefore, I mean, your consumers tier one cities in India, and therefore, they are very influenced by the West. They're very influenced by America. They're very influenced by the Gary V's of the world. I don't know how familiar you are with Gary V, but he's this entrepreneur from America who does a lot of social media content. He promotes the idea of growth, challenging yourself. And even when we hire people for Monk Entertainment, which is our media company, so when we're hiring 22-year-olds, they're extremely different from what even I was when I was 22, and I'm just 5 years older than them. But the whole thought process is completely different. So is that something that you'll think about a lot? Because I'm assuming you do, considering the fact that you've designed a minimalist app, you know, considering the fact that that is a big chunk of your audience, that 10 years down the line, 20 years down the line is where you'll really see the growth of Zerodha.
No, I mean, I think every single thing that we built today is for that crowd, you know, in the sense of the 20 to 30 year old crowd. I think what's also changed with this crowd is just the risk-taking appetite. You know, I think that's dramatically changed. You know, I can, because, you know, we've started the business from 2010 to now, right? As in, like 5 years back, you know, the way people used to respond, the younger crowd to stock markets, to what they're doing today, there's a drastic change in that. And I think why risk trading appetite, because, you know, I think it's capitalism at its, you know, it's at play, right? As in, it's people know that they have to make their money work. Just, you know, earning a salary isn't enough. You know, they, you know, whatever is saved, you know, that has to work for them, you know, and you can't, you know, and also I think there is this whole insecurity in terms of, you know, I think today's world, you can't really, the retirement ages has come down from 60 to 55 and etc. I don't know if a lot of people know about it, but as and when the retirement age is reducing, that means post-retirement, where you don't earn a salary, you have a lot of time to spend, which means that you have to start saving for your retirement as early as possible. And while there is a lot of excessive consumerism is a problem in this country, that is people, you know, spending, you know, like swiping out the credit card on the first day of the month and then trying to make up, you know, as and when. But there is this whole chunk of audience, a new bunch of people who understand that, you know, saving for retirement is an important concept, right? And and I think we need to find a way to, you know, make sure the entire crowd thinks like that. And you can't just have a small portion of this 20 to 30 year old saying, you know what, my dad retired at 60, but I might retire at 52 or 50, right? That means I have 10 years lesser to save, you know, for my retirement, right? And so you know, say if you start earning at 20 and say you save till 50, and so you have 30 years of earning and you have maybe another 20, 30 years of living off your savings, right? So how much do you need to save? You know, and the cost of living is continuously going up, right? As in, I don't think it's going to reduce ever, right? So I can see that, you know, people thinking of it, you know, like a big section of the 20 to 30 year old, but there's also a big section of 20 to 30 year old who wants to buy just, you know, I mean, if a person wants 50,000 rupees, wants to go spend 1 lakh rupees on an iPhone, which is ridiculous. I mean, it's probably the most stupid thing someone can do, right? But people, you know, get caught by this consumerism. And I think our marketers and advertisers just make it all so, you know, it's almost like a must have today, right? As in like the latest phone, the latest shoes, the latest whatever, right? I think what has also happened in this COVID era, right, is people have not been spending on this, you know, discretionary stuff, which means they've suddenly gotten, you know, access to this money, which was getting spent otherwise. Which is also the reason I think why, you know, people like us, you know, the businesses like us have done well, because that money which is in the bank, instead of going and finding its way to a Nike shoes or an iPhone, has, you know, probably gone into, you know, Reliance Industries or, you know, State Bank of India or some stock like that, you know. So, which is good. I mean, I think excessive consumerism is the one which is killing the climate, you know, it's killing the planet, you know, its problem. For the climate change, etc. So
on multiple levels, dude, it's not just climate change. It's probably, I think over time I've begun to look at it as a very minor part of self-harm also, because the more you own, right, you know, the more you're prone to misery. But that's a deep spiritual theory. More on that later. Go on.
Yeah. So even the education, so we have launched this like a mobile app for education. It's called Varsity. The education, the web, you know, it's also on the mobile. So we've seen a lot of, you know, and the thing, what we've done at that financial education is we've broken it down into small little non-intimidating kind of ways to, you know, teach people finance. And that's also doing quite well, you know, with the audience. And the startup ecosystem that we are working with, they've built a lot of very cool, you know, products for the 20 to 30 year olds. And, you know, that's also kind of done well. So yeah, so the focus is 20 to 30 year olds. I think India has the highest number of 20 to 30 year olds in the world. I think the way we are looking at our business is that you sit with them, teach them good habits, and, you know, wait for them to get richer in their lives. So, you know, so they automatically start generating more revenue for the business as well, you know, as and when this progresses.
So when it comes to financial behavior, now you're someone who's an expert in terms of the world of finance, and there would be good, great financial behavior. And then there would be the obvious trend in financial behavior that happens after COVID over the next 10 years. So let's take this phase after COVID. Over the next 10 years, what is good financial behavior versus what do you think will happen? Or will they actually merge? Will people actually get so educated financially that the trend you're predicting will be the actual best case scenario trend?
No, personally, I am currently, you know, kind of pessimistic about the world, you know, so I don't think this whole COVID situation is just gonna disappear. You know, I think stock markets are currently misleading. I don't think, you know, because, you know, stock markets around the world have bounced back, you know, which seem to say that, you know, we're all back to normal. I don't think so. I mean, because, you know, this, like, I've come out to a resort this weekend, and there are three people in this beautiful resort, you know, which can have 100 families. Right. So, and this is a listed company, you know, so, and, you know, like my friends who run gyms and et cetera, you know, like they're all saying, you know, even if they open, I think they're opening tomorrow. I don't think they're not expecting people to walk in. There are no inquiries coming in just because it's opening tomorrow. You know? So I think there's like a big behavioral change that's going to happen. And which means that, see, firstly, like what I'm pessimistic about is that I don't know how jobs will be created, right? I mean, how do you create new jobs in this country, right? If this old bunch of jobs are getting lost because of, you know, generally lesser money being spent by people, how do you create new jobs? If there is no new job, I mean, no new jobs, I mean, the only other option for government is to increase taxes or find other ways to take money from people who make money, right? So it's a... So yeah, so I don't really know what is the right, I don't know what's the right solution to get out of this problem. I think the first thing we all hope, I think should hope and pray, is that there is a vaccine out soon. And because, you know, we're all in such, you know, I think capitalism is a proper religion for this world right now, right? And suddenly, you know, in this religion, if people stop spending money, right, the religion can't survive. It's almost like, you know, like how going to temple or going to a mosque, etc., is, you know, is almost important for that religion to survive. In capitalism, I think you need, like, you know, people to be spending money for it to survive, right? And now suddenly there's a situation where people have stopped, you know. I think so. I'm kind of bearish for the next few years. So you know, unfortunately, the problem is, you know, I'm in a business where I can't do anything much by being bearish, you know, in the sense. I'm like, you know, it's a conflict of interest, right? As a business, you know, I can't, it's not like a stock I can sell today and then buy back after 3 years, right? As in, you have to, you know, we are just preparing ourselves to survive out this, you know, what we think the next 2-3 years are going to be tough periods. The behavior of the 20 to 30 year olds, I think, see, the last 6 months has been, I think, the most, I think most people in the world have gotten lucky in the last five, six months with the financials. Okay. Because Feb and March is when across the world the maximum of number of new investors came to the market. They bought stock and the stocks have gone up 20-40%, right? I don't think stuff like that will happen. You know, I mean, there is a saying that, you know, in a bull market, even the most stupid guy suddenly thinks he's a financial genius, right? And so, you know, so right now we are in that period where people who have bought stock and have made some money suddenly think that they're so super sharp, right? And now they can keep getting it right like this forever, right? And which is tough, you know. I mean, I don't think, like I said, you know, stock markets are probably the toughest place in the world to make easy money, you know. So there is there are other ways, you know. You probably have easier ways to make money is by going and playing a lottery than you know, than trying to make money off stock markets. You know, it's very tough here. So I think, you know, whenever there's, you know, reality hits that COVID is not a, you know, it's not over. This problem is not over. Stock markets will factor in that. It'll probably come down. Now, when it comes down, what will be the behavior of all those people who thought they were these financial geniuses, right? And suddenly, you know, you're sitting on stocks which have lost in value. What do you do at that time? Right? And historically, what I've seen in the last 20-25 years is when stocks don't do well and they lose some money, people become passive. You know, they say, let the stock recover and then I'll invest more money. So which is again not good for us for a business. And we've been trying as a company to inculcate some good habits on the trading platform. So for example, buying a penny stock, right? A penny stock is a stock which really doesn't have a real business behind it. It's just a paper, it's a company where there is a interesting trivia. There's one address in Calcutta where there are 200 listed companies in one address. And these are all companies which are trading on the stock exchange. So people end up buying such stocks. You buy a stock at 1 rupee and you think it'll become 10 rupees, right? But this 1 rupee stock really has no inherent value at all, right? So what we have done at Zerodha is that, we don't allow penny stocks to be purchased on the platform. Right? We are saying, let us protect the people from doing those kind of mistakes. But that still said, there are so many of these behaviors of people, which is very tough to change. And I think, if I had to, I don't know how this will play out over the next 6 months, 1 year, but I think when markets come down, a lot of these new first-time investors who came to the market, they'll say, let's wait it out. Let's wait for the stock markets to recover before we invest more money, which is not the right way to play it, right? The right way to play the stock market is not to try timing it, right? Because no one can time it. I think the right way to do this is allocate a certain portion of your income or saving to the stock markets, and then do it over a period of time. Don't try to put all of it at one time and saying, markets come down, let me buy, or like markets gone up, let me sell. I don't think that's the right way to do it. The idea is to be systematic, invest small amounts of money over time. Because when you do that dollar cost averaging, as they call it, which is you buy, say 5,000 rupees this month, next month 5,000, like a SIP or whatever you call it. So over a long period of time, your average costs, tend to come down, right? And that's a much better way for someone to play it, for someone like me, right? I've done this for 20, 25 years, so I can take risks, right? I mean, if I have to walk on a tightrope, for a profession, I would have practiced it for 10, 15 years, and then I'm doing the tightrope walk, right? A person who has no knowledge about stock markets, etc., I think, the right way to play it also is that. Now, if someone in listening thinks that they want to be a trader like me, and I can tell you after blowing up my account and struggling for 5 to 7 years, the lesson I learned is that don't risk more than what you can afford to lose. There is this, so today when I'm doing anything, I wouldn't bet more than 1 to 2% of my personal net worth on anything, because I know that if it blows out, I lose 1 to 2%. It's not going to kill me, right? I can always bounce back, So people don't think like that. A lot of, the problem is, when people have smaller amounts of money, say you have 1 lakh rupees in saving, right? How do you take a 1,000 rupee bet, is what they think, right? Or say a 5,000 rupees bet, So people want to put 1 lakh rupee into one stock and buy, buy everything with that one stock and hope to get lucky. And I don't think in the stock markets, hope is really a strategy, So it's, if someone's listening, the plan is, if you have 1 lakh rupees, find 10 stocks from different sectors and industries, distribute across it. Now, if you want to become a speculator, take 10,000 rupees in this 1 lakh rupees and speculate, right? You leverage, whatever, right? But make sure that you if you blow out the 10,000 rupees, don't add more, right? Now, if you make money, you're one of those guys who enjoys trading and makes 10,000, 10,000 becomes 15,000, then probably slowly increase that 10,000, but never, go to a point where more than like 20, 30% of your, savings are, being used for very active trading. Because in active, very active trading, you are leveraging, you can blow up very easily. And that's essentially, stuff that I try to teach people who are starting the markets.
Hey guys, so that was part one of our mega episode with Zerodha founder Nitin Kamath. It was all about the Zerodha story. I hope you all got some inspiration. But keep in mind, part two is a lot more about personal finance. It's kind of financial education for you. Very, very powerful episode. You guys are going to enjoy it. I also asked him a lot about his mindset, what goes on in his head outside of the world of Zerodha. I think you guys are going to enjoy part two as well. It's coming up next.